Regular Hours, episode 142 for December 15th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chris Kringle with the spirit of Christmas.
Oh, I know you are. I'm Pam Bedore.
and other fairies that live in our home.
Yeah, what we really need is a great Christmas story just to set the spirit of a holiday up.
Oh, I've got such a great story for you, Chip. It is a Charles Dickens classic. Charles Dickens wrote 5 Christmas stories on 5 different years. And in 1845, he brought us his best-selling of the 5, The Cricket on the Hearth, today, Chip.
Well, Pam, that means that's the best story, if it's the best-selling.
Everybody loves The Cricket on the Hearth. Everybody knows this story. It's one of those stories that we tell every Christmas when we're done with the Christmas carol.
No one will ever forget that first moment where they read this story and then try to figure out what's really going on and who these characters are.
Yeah. So you guys are giving me a sense of your answer to my first question, which was, which did you prefer most of these two? Just on a personal note, which did you prefer most in terms of A Christmas Carol or The Cricket on the Hearth?
Well, we discussed last week how wonderful A Christmas Carol is. It is great writing. It is great storytelling. It is great characters. We have seen that story in so many formats for the last 150, 170 years, and it's still a great story. This is not.
I'll say ditto to that.
And also, none of us had read it before, correct?
No.
I've never heard of this before we brought it to the book club last week, and I can see now why. This is not A Christmas Carol. This is not a story that I couldn't tell this story in summary right now. I couldn't tell you who these characters are. This is not good writing.
And in fact, that was my same experience. Even reading the story, I was having a hard time, like, why are we going through this? Especially when we got to the third part where we start getting this story. I kept feeling I was just not picking something. It was me. I wasn't picking something up on this story. And at the end of it, if you would have said, hey, Chip, I need you to write something down, write a paragraph of what you think this story is about, I don't think I could.
I agree.
Wow, I love the honesty, guys. This is awesome. Okay, so to play devil's advocate, thinking about A Christmas Carol, we just have a single consciousness, right? So we are in the one perspective. We're in Scrooge's perspective as he goes and looks in this very voyeuristic story, right? Mm-hmm. He goes and looks into these different places, looks into the past, present, future. There's that really metaphysical, temporal piece. But we have that one perspective all the way through. And one of the things that I think makes Cricket in the Hearth a little harder to follow is that we do have these characters that initially seem unrelated. But in a sense, I mean, this story should be more interesting because it has, like, you know, it has this couple, Peary Bingle and Dot. And
yeah, those are real names. Peary Bingle. Yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Peary Bingle. You know, the Peary Bingles from down the lane.
Okay, Dickens loves crazy names. You know that, the Pickwick Papers. But you do have this, couple, the older man, younger woman, he's very much in love with her. He's a little worried about whether or not she returns his feelings. And at Christmas time, he observes her hugging this guy and he worries. I mean, there's like, you know, there's jealousy, there's potential cuckoldry. I mean, there's a lot of like things going on in this story that might seem really interesting. There's like the blind girl and the fact that her father is trying to like create this world for her, which because of her lack of sight, she buys into, his narrative that they're financially more, you know, in better shape than they are. And you just worry for her. What's she going to do? She's like this blind teenager. She's so cool. She's so nice. She's putting eyes on little dolls, which is creepy and we'll get to. But there's a lot going on in this story that should be quite compelling. But I know what you're saying. It wasn't that gripping, right?
I think it's not good storytelling. I think you just told a better story in your summary than this story is in truth. I think that there are 20 nouns for every one verb in this story. There are lists of things. And in your summary, even in your summary, you said, there is this blind girl. That's not action. That's that's a statement of this thing exists. And this is throughout this story.
And I even didn't mention, so we kind of have these three groupings, right? So we have Peary, Bingle, and Dot. So the couple and the baby, unnamed.
The baby.
And the anxiety about whether Dot really loves her much older husband, John. Then we have the couple that's about to get married, May and Tackleton. Again, a much younger woman and a much older man. And so they're about to get married. Are they going to be happy? Who are they? We don't really know. And then we have the blind girl, Bertha, and her father, who's trying to make her feel like her life is much more secure than it really is. So those are the sort of three groupings of people.
And a cricket.
A gold star for being able to do a summary, though.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Three poems for the Bedore House.
Yeah, but you left out the cricket.
The most important part of this story. It's in the title.
Right. So you guys, my first question to you in thinking about this story was like, did you like it or not? And I'm not exactly shocked to hear that you guys didn't really like it. Now, second question is, considering that A Christmas Carol is such a huge part of the fabric of the holiday season in 2020. I mean, this is a text that's been adapted so many times. We were all so familiar with it that we weren't sure if we'd read it before, but we thought we probably had because we definitely knew that story, right? And we know those characters.
Uh-huh.
Now, we've not been, you know, we've not been immersed in the cricket in the hearth. So culturally, I don't think this story has the sort of staying power of A Christmas Carol. So let's dig in a little bit to why that would be. Why is this story, which was the most popular of the Dickens Christmas stories in the 1840s.
Most popular or best-selling? And is there a difference between those two words?
I would say best-selling. And I'm gonna, my first answer is, at what point is this a Christmas story? Is Christmas even present in this story?
There's toys.
You get married on Christmas.
Oh, there you go. I'm so sorry. That's right.
Right, it's, and Christmas
the day of marriage.
Right, and Christmas is comedy. Like, Christmas is the coming together, the feast, the celebration. Okay. Right, it's the
community. There is a community element to this, that we are working together on this in a spirit of unity, and that is something like Christmas, but yeah, it's not exactly Christmas. And
it's similar to A Christmas Carol in that way, though, that Christmas is this day which everyone has it off. Okay. And you celebrate with your family. It's not a time of gift giving. There's no Santa Claus or anything like that, but there is, and actually, I don't even know that there's church, but it is a time of celebration, community, family, okay, marriage, comedy.
Two points for both Fodor and Bedore.
But I guess it seems to me that there are three elements in this story that do not translate well into 2020 or probably the entire 20th century. I wouldn't want to speak to that, but oh my gosh, this is like the meanest podcast we've ever done. But so, for our book club discussion, we think we have brought you a terrible book, my friend. So I think there are three elements that don't translate well. The first one is the May-December relationship. Number two.
But the fact that her name is May.
Well, we're going to come to that. Number two is the cricket. And number three is the treatment of the blind girl. Okay. So that's my opinion. You guys could bring forward many other things that don't translate well. And I think
all those 60-year-old men and their 15-year-old wives.
That's the May-December relationship, my friend.
Certainly doesn't make anyone feel uncomfortable. Right. Oh, they're coming to dinner. Oh my God. What do we do?
So those are my three elements. Do you guys want to add anything to that? Or do you think that covers the most difficult to bring forward 180 years of the elements of this fine Christmas tale?
How much pain can you suffer through? All right, let's go with all three of these. I'm going with those three. I'm not adding any more. That would expand this conversation.
Chip! Okay, but you guys, can I just say that as an English professor, I think you learn just as much from books that you don't really enjoy as you do from books that you do. But we can discuss if that's true or not. But I feel like we're going to learn something about the Victorian consciousness through this conversation.
Do you?
I do.
Thank God.
Do you think that the characters learn anything in this? Is there...
Stephen, my dear, we have a story, just as we always, isn't Christmas really about conversion? For Charles Dickens.
Okay, yes. A change of heart. There is a change of heart that happens with the antagonist, but mm-hmm. It is so weak. It is such a, I'm sorry, I'm more sorry than I was this morning, he says. Like, really?
It was an awakening. It was a...
But it's off screen. The one character, and I don't even remember which character, one of the characters says, oh, he must have been visited by spirits last night. And I'm like, oh, good, that would be a good story to tell. Tell that story. No, wait, that's A Christmas Carol.
Can we just call it the Muppet twist, Steve, because everything happens off camera?
That was definitely a moment that was very Muppety and not Muppet Christmas Carol. The whole cricket is a whole... why? Why do we have crickets?
Let's start with the cricket. Because I think the cricket is perhaps the least translatable element of this story. And since the cricket is the title character, and we spend, you know, a good amount of time with the cricket to open this novel, what do we know about crickets in literature and crickets in popular culture? And what do we need to know about this fine cricket on the hearth?
Steve, let us travel east, right?
The beginning of this is in the Tang Dynasty in China between 600 AD and 900 AD. They had this idea of a lucky cricket. It makes sense to me, culturally, to think of, hey, there's a noise that is not unpleasing a sound. It's kind of like a sing-song noise. Let's figure out where this noise is coming from. And if that noise is happening in your home, that's an interesting, you know, conversation to have. Hey, what's that noise? That's a cricket. Oh, it must be lucky because it's in the house. So in the Tang Dynasty, they would actually build little cages and hold a cricket in the house for luck. They would have them suspended from the rafters and doorways as caged pets, but as a side note, they would also work as alarm systems, because I don't know how many crickets you've engaged in your home, but when they see or hear somebody approaching them, they stop that sound. So it's an anti-alarm. They stop making a sound when somebody approaches. So that's, I think, where we're getting the idea of the lucky cricket in this story. We see this in the movie Mulan in the 1980s, which is a wonderful Disneyfication of Chinese myth and adds that lucky cricket element. Still sticking with Disney for a little while, Pinocchio has a guardian angel, Cricket, who is that spiritual side of that story. Like, this is the right thing to do. That conscience that tells you what the right thing to do is. And we get a little bit of that spirituality of the cricket here at the beginning, where the cricket and the teapot are singing together, and it's a very interesting introduction to the spiritualness of this cricket that goes nowhere.
Well, I think the cricket does come back when John Peerybingle is struggling to process his notion that his wife is cheating on him. The cricket does help him to process that. So we'll come back to the cricket. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, as a professor, as a lecturer, the term cricket to me doesn't raise anything so lovely as some sort of little guardian angel. To me, like, hearing crickets is really, really, really bad.
Right? It means you're not reaching your audience. Yeah. Yeah. Like when Steve tells a joke.
or when we read the story and it ends.
We have to keep fighting or 2021. Oh, good, you laughed at it this week.
Yes.
Last week you didn't laugh at that. There was crickets last week.
Oh, that's because I heard it before. Now I'm accustomed to what the spirit of that story, that joke is. Very, very funny.
But I do think there's this notion, and the cricket represents the fairy, represents this other world that has an impact on ours. And like, we're just not that invested in that narrative today as people were in the Victorian period. I mean, remember, we just spent all that time with Arthur Conan Doyle, who totally believed in fairies, right? And we just don't, you know, for the most part.
Is that the issue with it? Because, you know, when you enter a story, you're entering their world where there is a set of like parameters. And if they said, "Hey, listen, there's going to be fairies and magical crickets in this story," then you either buy in or not. I don't think there's ever a buy-in by the reader in this. I have no problem kind of like reading a story and suspending, you know, a part of reality to get through it. But certainly,
you're not closed-minded. You're not against magical crickets.
That's right.
I'm not against
magical cricket.
I'm not against stories of magical crickets. There is no very explicit moment in this where Charles Dickens explains anything about this world. This is a very normal day in the life of these people, and these normal people are explained in these very normal terms, and there's a cricket. It's like, but which one is it? Which one is it, Charles?
Yeah, so you think there might be some genre trouble here?
I really do.
Between realism and fantasy, I can see that, sure. Now, the thing that I think so with the crickets, we might be open to them. We're not really engaged in this story, fair. So it doesn't translate well. I think the question of the May-December relationship is not just something that we don't get engaged in. It's actually something that we pretty strongly are against in the 21st century. So this idea of young girls marrying much older men, it creeps us out, right? Is that a fair thing to say? Like,
it's against our cultural norms, for sure.
I think of like Hugh Hefner or Larry King or Tony Randall, who were all, you know, just more December than anything.
December.
And then certainly marrying incredibly young people. And those young people are like, "Oh, yeah, we have so much in common." I'm going, do you?
Well, and it's interesting because here we have two May-December marriages. And I would just note that in this period, in the 1840s in England, the age of consent was 12 for girls and 14 for boys. I'm just throwing that out there for your
two book. Different ages? 12 for girls?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. So
Bear in mind, people lived a lot shorter lives then, so percentage-wise, that number might work out. But in terms of maturity, yes, people matured differently then, too. But, boy, 12 is awful young.
Including physical maturity, Steve.
Yeah.
Including physical maturity. So
certainly
that's kids are maturing for, like, many women.
Romeo and Juliet were 13 and 14.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, 13 and 14 is way better than 13 and 50, but anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And kids are certainly... their bodies are maturing much faster today. But certainly, mentally, they're just not adults. Mm-hmm. They're not adults.
And one of the things that I think is... really, really creepy for us today is the notion. So we have May, who's literally called May in this May-December marriage situation. So May and Tackleton, we don't get into their relationship as deeply. But Peary Bingle and Dot have a very similar age range. And there comes a moment where Peary Bingle talks about the gap in age. He says, quote, "I am not a young man. I loved my little Dot because I had seen her grow up from a child in her father's house, because I knew how precious she was, because she had been my life for years and years. There's many men I can't compare with who never could have loved my little Dot like me, I think." Ooh.
Yeah. Blah,
blah. That's a tough one. Like, oh, wow, you saw her grow up. You've known her since she was a child. I mean, that's not really a point in your favor, old dude. Like, that's...
For the record, we're all uncomfortable with that.
Right. But look at how that's narrated, right? That's forward as a positive. So that's one of the really, really big gaps that we see between a Victorian consciousness and our own, is that we are all, like, undoubtedly creeped out. There's no way you can produce an adaptation of this story today.
Starring Rodford Redford and introducing young child actor.
Like, no, you can't do it.
I think beyond that, though, I think the idea of the relationships, the community, the people coming together and having this normal story is kind of what the Hallmark Christmas movies are. These are normal people having normal stories. And yes, then maybe there's this one spiritual element, this one lucky cricket piece to it. So I think you could adapt some of this, but it would be boring.
You don't have to rewrite the thing. You'd have to rewrite it with so many other premises, and certainly, as you were getting ready to, and as I interrupted you, sorry, but you'd have to find something compelling about this.
There has to be a character arc here that is stronger than the character arc that we get, for sure.
What about Bertha? Okay, so if you're not that invested in Peary Bingle, in Mr. and Mrs. Peary Bingle, John and Dot and their unnamed baby, what about Bertha, the blind girl who has learned how to make dolls, makes the dolls, you know, using sense of touch, who does not realize that her father is trying to make her think everything's fine. Oh, our house is beautiful. I'm super hale and hearty. And everything's great, when really he's just barely holding things together. And keeping his daughter happy is really the only thing he has in his life. There's a lot of potential pathos there.
And you're describing exactly the film adaptation from 1967, the Rankin and Bass animation, where that's exactly what they did. They focused on the one story of this blind girl who is living a life that is different from reality because her father cares about her so much that he's willing to outright lie to her to keep her happy, even though ultimately that blows up in his face.
And deception, we all work with our children. We want to work, things happen through life, and you want to make things age appropriate and stuff like that. But certainly this blind child is so disconnected from the real reality. She there is nothing that's truth in her life.
And let me bring in a couple quotations about that, because this is where I think the writing is a little bit better. So when he first introduces Bertha and Caleb Plummer, there's the kind of class critique that is so familiar to readers of Dickens' more famous novels. So he says, Caleb Plummer and his blind daughter lived all alone by themselves, as the storybooks say, and my blessing, with yours to back it, I hope, on the storybooks for saying anything in this workaday world. Caleb Plummer and his blind daughter lived all alone by themselves in a little cracked nutshell of a wooden house, which was, in truth, no better than a pimple on the prominent red brick nose of Gruff and Tackleton. The premises of Gruff and Tackleton were the great feature of the street, but you might have knocked down Caleb Plummer's dwelling with a hammer or two and carried off the pieces in a cart. So we see this vast inequity that really marks the Victorian period, where you just have these big, comfortable houses, Tackleton the toy maker, and then this little falling down shack that Caleb is trying to sell to his daughter.
And in that quote, we have that first person aside that is the voice of Charles Dickens speaking specifically to his audience. I imagine that this was a performance first, and then he wrote it down and published it, because that sounds to me like he stopped reading and said these words to an audience.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That we're trying to redeem the story a little bit, and that may be the case. I mean, other than being aware of what's going on right there, basically there are people who are certainly struggling during this time, as historically people have done. The reality, though, of it is what are we supposed to take from it, other than there's just, I mean, is there some kind of redemption later on, like, oh, we should probably help these people who have the man who's deceived his child, who lives in the pimple house,
There's a degree of that here, but it's not nearly as overwhelming a statement as in A Christmas Carol.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And then I want to go turn briefly to another quote about Caleb and Bertha. I have said that Caleb and his poor blind daughter lived here. I should have said that Caleb lived here and his poor blind daughter somewhere else, in an enchanted home of Caleb's furnishing, where scarcity and shabbiness were not, and trouble never entered. Caleb was no sorcerer, but in the only magic art that still remains to us, the magic of devoted, deathless love, nature had been the mistress of his study, and from her teaching, all the wonder came. Whoa, so what's he doing in that passage?
I think that he is telling the audience how wonderful the power of storytelling is. That the magic of his words telling us this tale, transporting us to this other place, taking away all of the day-to-day problems that we're seeing, especially in the 1840s, and being able to see from a different imagined place is the message here.
Yeah, there's this metafictional element of both of those stories where he is talking about the power of storytelling, right? Which is very much picking up on the theme of A Christmas Carol, where a ghost can show you, can bring you into an empathetic relationship with other people, which helps you to see who you are, but mostly who you can be, right? So he's picking up on that theme again here. Now, there's also something super unsavory about this, which is that why can Caleb succeed in fooling his daughter? Oh, because she's disabled. And it's fool the disabled, right? Like, that's awesome. So this is really, this is why it's really, maybe someone did a movie about it in 1967, but there's no way you'd be able to pitch this today, right?
Look at this, my pitch meeting right here. We're going to have a blind person that she's going to be totally, like, not aware of.
Oh.
Right? I mean, it's terrible.
You're right.
Terrible.
That is cringy for sure.
Right. And so, okay, you guys. So I looked up the scholarship on this novel because I also read it. I didn't share quite as much as you guys did at the beginning, but I also did not close this book and think, wow, I love Charles Dickens, because I do love Charles Dickens, but this isn't why I love Charles Dickens. And so I went and looked at what kind of scholarship people do on this. And I found an article that I really, really enjoyed by Elizabeth Gitter, The Blind Daughter and Charles Dickens's Cricket on the Hearth. And this is from Studies in English Literature of 1999. And here's how her argument goes. I really enjoyed this article, by the way. So she opens with the end, the final scene where everybody is paired off except for Bertha, the blind girl. And she notes that within Victorian literature, blind characters are not allowed to marry. And so within that sort of tragedy versus comedy mode, there is no comedy for the blind unless they're cured, she explains. And there is a whole literature of people who find their sight, which is, by the way, as she explains, super unrealistic, because in real life, when people who are blind from birth have their sight restored, which there's been like 40 cases total ever, they're really disoriented and their neural pathways can't process the stimulus. So It's not like they're suddenly like, and then I could see, it was awesome. She notes, and if you ever read this story again, and I have a feeling you might not, you would notice now that we've looked at this, there are so many metaphors about sight and seeing, about spying, about so many visual metaphors throughout. And she pulls tons of them in. I was like, wow, that really is pretty remarkable. We have Edward, who is in disguise so that he can spy on May. We have Tackleton, who invites John to spy on Dot and Edward. We have Bertha, who's got all those eyes that she's putting on the dolls. Like, the metaphors of the visual pervade this entire story. And then we have Caleb, who tricks Bertha only because she doesn't have access to the sense of sight. Then Gitter comes to this notion that I thought was really interesting. She says, the fear of cuckoldry, central to the Cricket on the Hearth, is also a recurrent theme of ocular cure literature, which I didn't know. So this notion that if you have someone who's blind, they're always afraid of being fooled, of being cheated on.
Okay, I could see that.
Yeah. And then she makes this statement that I really want your opinion on, because I can't decide if she's right or wrong. She says, at once helpless and ridiculous, Bertha is the object of our scorn as well as our pity. As much as Dickens insists upon the innocence of her father's lies and deceptions, and also, through the device of Tackleton's comic asides, invites his sighted readers to laugh at the spectacle of her ridiculous behavior, to participate in the sadistic pleasures of teaching the blind, a sadistic pleasure still familiar to us from a host of Tormenting the Blind movies. And then she goes on to name like 10 recent Tormenting the Blind movies from the 1990s. I was like, whoa. So what do you guys think? Do you think the audience here is invited to participate in, I don't know, an uncomfortable ridicule of the blind girl?
I did not see that at all. I did not have a feeling that invitation to ridicule her was even on the table in this narrative.
I'm going to add something to that. This could be a very bright person reading into a story that was really written for the general public, who may not have the skills to pull that from the literature.
I do agree that I think that this writer, this critic, is digging deep to find something in this tale.
Well, and it's interesting, though, because I know exactly what you're saying. But at the same time, I do feel like there's this, like, we are lucky not to be Bertha. right? Like we know the truth, just like Caleb does and Bertha doesn't. So there is this notion that literature sometimes gives you that's super uncomfortable and that we do not like in the 21st century of making the reader superior to the character.
Like Band-Aids, Christmas song where Bono sings out, thank God it's them instead of you, when talking about the starving people of Africa.
Maybe. I thought of that, but yeah, maybe. And so then Gitter goes on to notice that Tackleton is rehabilitated at the end. Tackleton gets not like a happy ending exactly, but he says, you know what? May, even though you promised to marry me, I'm so happy for you that your young, virile, beloved fiance has actually returned. And so you have my total blessing, right? And Bertha doesn't really get a happy ending. As this article ends, sightless and partnerless, playing her harp so that others can dance, she is the suffering servant who allows Dickens in the end to turn a blind eye to incestuous and guilty desires. Through her, he is able to make light of darkness. So this is a really dark reading of this story. I don't think it's totally inaccurate, though. I think part of the reason we didn't like this story is that it looks like a happy Christmas story on one way that it ends in that comedy of wedding and people pairing off, and Dot didn't really cheat on Perry Bingle. She really loves this elderly man who has known her since childhood and is the father of her child. But like, it's creepy. The story really pulls on social cultural mores that we no longer hold or share. I don't know. That's my read.
Certainly this is a very, deep analysis of a story that I was even having a hard time just relating to.
Right.
And I think there's, that disconnect was throughout the whole story. It wasn't like I was drawn in. And I don't think, when you compare it to A Christmas Carol, and yes, I've seen so many productions of it that it almost it's boring. But you can read it as a fresh story. This one is, foreign, but also just disconnected from what I would find enjoyable. So I struggle with this. The story is in total.
And I think again that we see that this was the best selling of the five stories, and I think that it's because of Charles Dickens himself. I think that part of the disconnect that we are seeing in reading this material is that I believe this was a stage performance first and then written down for publication afterwards. We see Dickens himself as a character at the beginning and at the end of this story. It begins in the voice of Charles Dickens. The kettle began it. Don't tell me what Mrs. Peerybingle said. I know better. Mrs. Peerybingle may leave it on record to the end of time that she couldn't say which of them began it, but I say the kettle did. I ought to know. I hope. That first-person narrator, is not a character in this story. It is Charles Dickens telling us this tale. Then we get to the ending. Pam, there's an ending to this story.
Oh, thank God.
It was a very short novella. But it seems like for Dickens, Christmas is a time of conversion, right? And so at the end, Tackleton comes to the house of merriment and says, friends, one and all, my house is very lonely tonight. I have not so much as a cricket on my hearth. I have scared them all away. Be gracious to me. Let me join this happy party. And of course, everyone says, yes, yes, Tackleton. Please do join us. It's the Christmas season. We can all be friends together.
And then there's this first-person narrator that breaks into this scene again. There's even three dots where it breaks the fourth wall, and we hear the narrator, this Dickens character, says, "But what is this? Even as I listen to them blithely and turn towards Dot for one last glimpse of a little figure very pleasant to me, she and the rest have vanished into air, and I am left alone. A cricket sings upon the hearth, a broken child's toy lies upon the ground, and nothing else remains. This is, hey everybody, that's a story I told, and those people didn't really exist. You're welcome."
Oh dear God, the emotions are just in my mind at this time. I went from tears to just disbelief.
I would love to have met Charles Dickens to see his performance of this story, and I'm certain that we would get a different feeling from it than reading it on the page, or even having an audio narrator, somebody else other than Charles Dickens, reading this to us. I think we would get a totally different feeling from the actual man himself.
We'll give him that benefit of the doubt.
It is funny, though, how so many of his long sort of social critique novels are so compelling. You care so deeply about those characters. And yeah, I don't think that really translated into this very short seasonal tale.
But it does in A Christmas Carol. You do care about those characters. Those characters are so well fleshed out, and the story is so intriguing, the beginning, middle, and end. This misses that mark for sure.
Listen, we've got another opportunity next week. He's 50-50 so far. What are we going to read next week?
Next week is The Battle of Life. This one was published in 1846, the year after The Cricket on the Hearth. And he's got some splaining to do.
Yeah, and none of us has read this, right? We have no idea what we're going into.
Exactly. And now I'm worried. Right.
Always exciting.
I'm pretty sure this is about the day of the dead and the Mexican tradition. That's the Book of Life, not the Battle of Life.
Well, this is another holiday treat, and one of the five that he wrote for novellas he wrote for the holiday season. So here we go.
I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam? You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. We would love to hear from you. What is your opinion? Are we wrong? Is this a great story that we read incorrectly? What is your opinion of The Cricket on the Hearth? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. Tell us we're wrong. Explain yourself, please, Mr. Dickens. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chris Kringle, Spirit of Christmas.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
See you in the future.
Make it end.
All right.
And...